So I'll introduce our moderator tonight, John Leonard, Chair of the Religious Studies Department at Lampard College.
It's good to see so many familiar faces now. We're becoming kind of a family. But for those who are new, who are coming for the first time, welcome. And for your sake, I will reintroduce our speakers, both of whom have addressed this august committee and in previous sessions. Marshall O'Nallion is professor of physics at the UW, born in Baton Rouge, Louisiana.
Read the stick.
This is how he described himself to me the first time. Eagle Scout at 13, U.S. Air Force officer, UW since 1987, lives in Stoughton. And Steve Fortney also is living in Stoughton. He's a former school teacher and an author of multiple books. And as you see from the poster, he is a Buddhist initiate in both the Tibetan tradition and the Japanese Zen tradition. And I think that that's enough introduction for this evening. You will enjoy them, I hope, I trust, as we have in the past. So I don't know who's going first. Marshall?
Thank you all for coming. What I'm going to talk about is begin with a surprise that I had teaching a course. And after that, I'm going to pose a question. Of course, I'm going to answer it since it's my job. But I'll give you a chance to think about it too, and then you can have the fun of correcting my answer when we talk about it during question time. So let me start by telling you an observation. I'm teaching a physics class for the first time at UW on science and religion this semester, and we're using this book. In the process, we've had guest speakers, many of whom came here, and these have included Christian ministers of several types, Jewish rabbis, and, well, I was surprised. The book theme, one of them anyway, is both transcendence, religion, and observation, science, are valid ways of seeking truth. Fair enough. We concentrated on the bad guys being ideologies of all sorts, political, economic, social, and religious. Consequently, we spent a fair amount of time in the class and in the book talking about religious ideologies, fundamentalisms of different sorts, Christian and Muslim and others. Well, that was because they're easy. These ideologies were selected. They have in common the idea of an inerrant source document and an absolute truth. The surprise was, for me, the response not of fundamentalists, I didn't expect to get Christmas cards from them, but rather the number of people, both the students in the class and other religious figures, who assumed that our criticism of those who believe in inerrant text were criticisms directed against them as well. Protestant ministers, Jesuit priests, Catholic and Protestant laymen all reacted in the same way, in a way that surprised me. For instance, so far as I know, our book has garnered 18 reviews. Okay. Of these, 4 are unfavorable. What do these 4 have in common? They are written by Christian religious authorities, Catholic and Protestant, some evangelical and fundamentalist. Those I expected. But not the criticisms that came from Christian students and not from mainline Christian denominations, which do not describe themselves as fundamentalist. In fact, not only do they not describe themselves that way, they reject the idea of being fundamentalist, they explicitly. Well, these people told me that doubt was essential in their religious faith, and it was essential to learn the truth, learning the truth. Well, that said, how come, since we were agreeing on doubt, the reaction? Well, obviously there's going to be more than one reason. You're talking about many people. But the more I thought about it and the more carefully I looked at their reactions, both the rational ones and the emotional ones, the clearer that one reason came to me, and that is our book and our argument was perceived by these people as, in a sense, a threat. It was a threat not to the process of living with doubt while seeking truth, which they endorsed, but rather to the institutional authority that laymen have given to their religious denominations, in some cases, and that the religious authorities have incorporated into their own identity. So let's take that one at a time. I grew up in a Methodist church in the South, in Louisiana, as our moderator has said so eloquently. Most people I know who attend a religious group, church, synagogue, mosque, temple, or otherwise, go there not just for the theology, which most of us don't really know all that well, but we're social people. We go, if we voluntarily associate with others, for social reasons very often, not entirely, but partly. If you're an adult, not a little kid and told you have to go to church by your parents, if you're an adult and you can freely choose and you associate, you do so because you get social benefit from it. Otherwise, you don't do it. In most religious groups, there are authority figures. In some of them, it's a priestly hierarchy, and others, preachers, different words, but in all cases, some type of authority has been ceded by the members to their leaders. Well, that suggests to me that when we criticize fundamentalists as investing their sources with inerrancy, that would be the extreme of authority, having no mistakes at all. This is the extreme of what some religious groups do vis-a-vis their own authority. So before, for both social reasons and because many people who go to these religious groups do in fact cede authority in matters of religion, our criticisms are taken as an attack. It raises a question, why would a person cede authority in religion to anyone? And most people are not comfortable with such a question. The individual is one thing, but the reaction of the religious authorities has actually been worse. It's been stronger. It's been more virulent. Rather than having you just take my word for it, not of course that you shouldn't accept everything I say as gospel, but just in the case, let me just illustrate the point. Quote, they, meaning Stephen Fortney and myself, appear to regard most theistic religions as simply ipso facto false, end quote. In common with the reaction of religious authority figures, this review simply misstates on the one hand and ignores on the other. It's a simple example, it's milder than the others, but it's representative. Let's consider what's said. According to the review of this book, we regard most theistic religions as simply ipso facto false. There are over 1,000 theistic religions in the world. right now. And if you include the 6,000 years of history that we discuss in this book, there's been well over 1,000 theistic religions. Some of them no longer exist. How many do we discuss in the book? Let me give you a hint. It's not 1,000. It's fewer than 10. So it would be impossible to regard what's in any short, thin book about religion as representative of what they might or might not think about most theistic religions. That's just silly. But it illustrates the point of most of the reactions. It exaggerates. And it employs a reducto ad absurdum argument to say that we're mistaken. But it's also noteworthy for what's not there. This whole panel is on faith and reason. Religion broadly construed and science broadly construed. But nowhere in the review does the word science appear. Nor do the arts. They don't exist. So when a person focuses on only one issue, it pretty well tells you what that person cares about. One Roman Catholic priest, as published in the Badger Herald article on my class in September of this year, said, quote, "A Catholic can and should entertain doubt as long as he or she doesn't enter into a, quote, radical stage of disbelief or rejection," end quote. But although humans have a moral obligation to search for the truth, they should not adopt a permanent state of skepticism. Catholic teaching is that we are capable of seeing the truth and need to respond to it. To do otherwise would be to reject the truth. That's what would cause you to lose your soul. The reviewer, according to the article, had no problem with the university offering a class espousing the virtues of skepticism, which the article did not say, but thought it should be balanced with contrasting views. They should also teach a class, quote, "they should also teach a class on the virtue of finding a dogma and living by it," end quote. Well, let's go through that. Not adopt a permanent state of skepticism. Let's consider the implications of such a statement. We are instructed not to enter into a radical state of disbelief. I don't know what radical state of disbelief means, but whatever it is, we're clearly not supposed to do that. But in a approved level of doubt is acceptable. In seeking truth, we should not be permanently willing to change our opinions as new evidence arises, because that would be a permanent state of skepticism. Even better, there are virtues to finding a dogma and living by it. Well, you just got rid of all science to begin with, because the sine qua non of science is to always be skeptical and never be sure absolutely. So, hasta la vista, as Arnold says. But there was a more remarkable set of opinions provided in the same article by one of our local evangelical authorities. Quote, "the search for truth should start with faith rather than doubt. Looking at the origin of truth or the Creator, that is a good beginning." The reviewer, the authority figure, also disagreed with the view that science and religion are equal paths toward truth, as O'Neillian claims. "Faith in God is more balanced than the relevant truth we conjure up by observation. We should bring research or discovery in line with faith. Oy vey. That's quite remarkable. Science should be brought in line with faith. We should start searching for truth by faith, not by doubt. Faith, not the religious channel of truth-seeking mind, faith alone is more balanced than science. Such opinions require no elaboration from me. If followed, these views would be the end of science, the end of rationality, and of the individual seeking truth with all the doubt and all the uncertainty that accompanies such a search. These are not the only reactions from authority figures, but they are representative. What do these authority figures have in common? A creed. Not fundamentalism. Not an inerrant text. Not a belief in absolute truth. But a creed. Now, they are not the only religious groups running loose in the neighborhood. There are also progressive Christians, Hindus, Buddhists, some branches of Judaism, and some branches of Islam. For example, consider the contrast between what you've just heard with a review of the same book, the same material, by a man named Daniel Leichty at Illinois State University, who writes book reviews for the Progressive Christian magazine. I'm going to be bragging on myself, but I did not pay him to say these words. In a very engaging narrative, these authors weave a tapestry of interconnected truth-seeking in the areas of science, the arts, and the humanities, including especially religion. Each of these characteristic modes of truth-seeking offers its valuable insights and perspectives, and each also contains its own characteristic ways of getting off track, becoming dogma, and out of balance with other ways of seeking truth. Recognition that truth-seeking is a search for integrated balance, human life and thought, is understood as living with doubt. But in this light, doubt can be embraced as a necessity, friend of the truth. And in so doing, living with doubt becomes an intellectual and spiritual adventure of a life well lived. I apologize for bragging on myself. I continue. This is a very important book, and although bits and pieces of this approach can be found scattered throughout the literature, this is the only presentation I know that puts it together in just this way. Well, nice review. My point is this. We're going to talk about Eastern religions tonight, but the point is not that they're Eastern. The point is that they're not non-creedal. The point to me is that they do not presuppose answers either in dogma or in process of finding truth. They certainly do not bring science into line with faith, which from my point of view goes all the way back to Galileo and the Inquisition, if you'll pardon my editorial comment. As a physicist, we tend to have long memories of Galileo. Long memories of Galileo. So let me, as I promised, end my little spiel with posing a question, which will tie, in fact, to this creedal matter. Let's stop and think for a minute today, not history, today. Where are the places in the world where people do the best scientific work? Japan, South Korea, People's Republic of China, Taiwan, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand, India, Western Europe, Russia, North America. Where not? Much of Latin America, North Africa, Sub-Saharan Africa, Middle East, Central Asia, and parts of East Asia, in particular Burma, Malaysia, Indonesia. I'm not basing that on my opinion, I'm basing that on the citation index of science, numbers. So why? You can find a lot of poor countries in the world that I just listed that don't do good science because they're poor. But you can find countries, when you normalize for income, that do far, far better. You can find countries that have a lot of problems, social, economic, political problems. But you can find countries that also have social, economic, political problems than in that first list of mine that do much better. What is the difference? Clearly there's many factors, but let me pose one to you for consideration. I argue that the key, not the only factor, but one big factor, is that science is a protected activity, not subordinate to and determined by political or religious constraints. And I argue that that accounts more for the activities that do well and the activities that do less well than almost any other single factor if I look around the planet today. It's not a political system. People's Republic of China, despite what we may think of the Republican Party, is even more a one-party state. And it's not economic. There are countries in that first list that are communist, socialist. There are countries that are much more free market types. That's what I argue. It's the question of whether science is protected from being controlled by, dictated to, and limited by political and religious diktat. That is the biggest single factor. And that's all.
I'm going to have to nestle up to this. I'm coming at the tail end of a 3-week viral cold that I'm sure you've heard about. I'm really sick of it. But I want to address the other side of the issue. I'm going to change tactics a little bit. In the first place, to begin to think about the impact of the discovery of the East on the part of the West, that is a platitude now. I can remember one time, I think it was 1976 when the Dalai Lama was here for the first time. I went to hear him speak on a very difficult subject on emptiness by Nagarjuna. And I remember going to the meeting and wondering, I said, I wonder what ever happened to all those 60s people? You know, where did they go? Well, I got to the school and we had to move out of the auditorium into the gym because there were so many people, and about half of the audience was in shirts and the other half were these people in tie-dyes and all this sort of stuff. They were there, They had just simply gone underground for the most part and showed up when a man like the Dalai Lama shows up. I can also think in the 50s when I was growing up, I'm pretty elderly here, I'm 70 years old. I can remember grocery stores in the 50s. And now I remember them now. And even in the standard grocery stores, there's all kinds of stuff there with health food and tofu and tandoori and all this stuff that just simply didn't exist 25 or 30 years ago. So in a certain sense, what I'm suggesting here is that the East has kind of died into the fabric of Western thinking. I will go into that in a little bit more doubt or a little bit more detail later. Just a quick summary for those of you who have not been here up until this point, although I do recognize a number of familiar faces. We need to be aware of the function of doubt, not only in science, but also in literature and religion. And I'm thinking particularly not necessarily of a narrow sectarian definition of religion. I'm thinking of the mystical basis for all religions, and this is something that's very important. We have talked about in the past that the mystical experience or the zero experience, as one of the great writers on mysticism describes it as the zero experience, is basically an aesthetic experience. This means, and we talked about this I think last week to a certain extent, that all institutional religions are essentially works of art in response to the mystical event. And you can do this by looking at the poetry of the prophets, the moral power of Jeremiah and of Isaiah, 2nd Isaiah particularly, Hosea and Micah. You can look at the histories that were written in the early part of the Old Testament. There is no finer dramatic dialogue, I don't think, than the original form of the book of Job. And then you have the supreme artist, the supreme genius of the Levant, of course, among others, but particularly Jesus of Nazareth. His parables and his aphorisms are unique. There's a unique voice there, a unique voice of genius there, and certainly an artist of the first order. Short stories also are included in all of this. We also heard a great deal about science, and Marshall has just reinforced the emphasis that we have had on science in the course of these lectures and in the course of the doing of the book. As I say, the Eastern traditions have infiltrated the West. One of the things that I would like to think about in terms of how this operates has very little to do with what could be called the technical vocabulary of Buddhism or Hinduism or Taoism or any of those things. To me, the whole operation that ultimately results in science and in artistic production and in the life of inwardness begins with, and here's one technical term out of Zen Buddhism, with what the Zen Buddhists call the immaculate consciousness, or the ordinary mind, clear, immaculate awareness. And this means that you look at things, you see things, without presuppositions or prejudgments. The mind is completely open. And under those circumstances, you go into the actual work of science and art in the inward way in two or three different ways. First of all, the most important is a close observation of the cosmos, and then off of that, in science, the work of experiment and observation. The repeatable experiment is certainly the way that we can approximate a slow understanding of a worldview. In science, all the major paradigms of science. In art, it's the creation of the enduring image. I mentioned this before. That, for example, you can read Gilgamesh or audit Lear and still have something teaching you out of those things, because the images that are created by those works of art do in fact endure. And to me, the creation of enduring images and the act of the repeatable experiments are cognate processes. The method in the inward way, of course, is meditation, and it is these three things that create science and art and the wisdom traditions. And this is, when you put it all together, you can come up with what can be described as a modern worldview. Now, most of us do not necessarily live at that level. Our conventional worldview is the one that we have been taught from childhood on. We have taken in from all of the education and all of the informal education socially that we have experienced over the years. The power of language and nationality, I think, determines that our common life is a rich mixture of the primary way of those three branches of the clear perception, on the one hand, science, art, and the inward way, the wisdom tradition, and the way that we have been brought up conventionally. It's a very complex dialectic involved that certainly richly informs most of our common life. Now, as I say, the East has infiltrated the West. And this is an old story. This is nothing terribly surprising about this. The first indication of this was the work of a linguist by the name of Sir William Jones. India Jones, he was called. He was a functionary of the English Empire in India in the 18th century. And he was the one that first noticed that there was a kind of a relationship between Sanskrit and Greek and Latin. The man spoke 22 languages fluently and could read 36. He was an amazing human being in that respect. And he began to write basically what became the theory of the Indo-European theory of languages, the hypothesis of the Indo-European family. He published in 1776 a book called The Institutes of Hindu Law. And then shortly after that, he published a play by the name of Shakuntala, which became very famous in the West. Faust was enthusiastic over it. Not Faust, Goethe was enthusiastic over it. And through him, Emerson and Thoreau. So you can look at, there's hymns to Brahma, for example, in the Mozart canon. There's a poem to Brahma in the poetry of Emerson. Thoreau called himself a yogi at one point. Well, they were excited about these new discoveries. Now, we've passed the fad stage in the 60s particularly. We're no longer in the 60s. In those days, all you had to do was blow a little grass and drop some acid, and all of a sudden you were a Hindu or a Buddhist or a Taoist or an Apache, for all I know. I was just old enough to kind of miss that, but young enough to appreciate what was going on. There are something like, according to some of the statistics I've read, something like 5 million Buddhists in the country. As you know, Deer Park is just between here and Stoughton. It's one of the major centers of Tibetan Buddhism. There are 38 Dharma centers in Wisconsin alone. And I looked up some of these things. There was one in called the Hay River Buddhist Center in Ridgeland, Wisconsin. Now, do you know where Ridgeland, Wisconsin is? Way up north in the farm belt up there in the west north central part of Wisconsin. About 10 miles north of the family farm that my dad grew up on. I mean, it's just amazing to me that Hay River Buddhist Center in Ridgeland, Wisconsin. There's a Hindu temple in Milwaukee. The Shakti bookstore has Hindu roots. It goes back to the Himalayan Institute that has been around for a number of years. Eastern thinking, Christian, Jewish, and Islamic mysticism, and science, from a careful looking at their roots, have the same investigational bias. That is to say that all of these particular traditions, scientific, religious, and artistic, and the rest of it, are monist in inflection. That is to say, they do not assume that there's a reality outside the reality that we see. The universe is one, from a scientific point of view, is one thing. Now, what is in, I can't figure out. As a matter of fact, when I begin to get close to some of the paradigms of astrophysics, I tell Marshall that when I feel a sense of nausea, that I think I'm probably coming pretty close to the truth. So the more nauseated I get, the closer to the truth I am. This is a very odd way of doing things. Most of the normative traditions, and this is what Marshall was talking about earlier, have, in fact, a kind of a dualistic worldview. Now, this is not the mystical inflection of these faiths. It is not science or mysticism or anything like that. It is the older denominational normative churches. God is out there. It's a kind of an external inflection. You address God in prayer. God is separate from nature. Nature is ontologically corrupt. And if you're a Greek, nature is inert. But the realities are outside of these things. The monist view is quite different from that. In some of the Lutheran churches that I am aware of, there has been developing, in some evangelical churches as well, a sense of earth care. There's a Lutheran notion of stewardship that says you take care of the things that have been given to you. In this case, it has to do with the take care of the earth that you live in. This is also true of some of the evangelical movements within the last couple of years, actually. The monist way, from the point of view of the wisdom tradition, assumes that there's an inward address, that the sacred, the divine reality, however you want to call this, is something that you are deeply involved in and a part of. There are two ways to describe this, one less satisfactory than the other. Pantheism is one and panentheism is the other. Panentheism is the notion that God is both transcendent and immanent at the same time. Nature hides the form and substance of the divine. God is immanent in man. Man is of nature. Man is, by virtue of his egoism, alienated from his true nature. God is consciousness, a form of consciousness, or mystery. In this particular outlook, awakening is awakening into the realities that are within you. And this is basically by meditation and not by prayer. Though there is a communal life, a community life, the Sangha, but the style of this particular mythology is basically an inward style. It is psychological and individual. Now, science from the very beginning, of course, is monist. You just assume by looking at the universe, if you start off by what Darwin did, and you know, write treatises on barnacles, for Pete's sake. I mean, he started off very little, and he began ultimately to expand and to expand, and ultimately came up with his evolutionary hypothesis. Some of this is more direct. Richard Davidson last week had a brilliant series of questions and answers in which he established a scientific basis for some of the outcomes of meditation. And this, I think, was with some success. This is called by Alex Comfort, this whole process, this whole modernizing process, is called the Navayana, or the new vehicle. And I want to read just one short quotation from his book, Reality and Empathy. What will the next intellectual achievement be of humanity? Any intellectual model not based at its point of contact with reality on science is defunct or deficient in advance. My guess would be that in some way the new model will be the disciplined incorporation of introspection. This is what Richard was talking about last week. Yogis and intronauts have not been verification or hypothesis-minded. Scientific empirics have worked to keep introspective and observer biases out. The synthesis will be difficult, but interesting, and the results novel. Well, This could be the head note for the book that Marcia and I just finished writing. In science, of course, developing from this is the ecological movement. We know that Mother Nature will bite us if we misbehave too seriously. The religious impulse is not dead in literature. In the homepage of the Library for America, it turns out that there are something like 200 poets over the last 400 years of our existence that have been writing seriously about spiritual matters. And some of these are quite radical in their outlook, but no question about it that this religious impulse is alive and well. Now, listening to Marshall and listening to me, you might think at the outset there are basically two options so far as religion are concerned. The fundamentalists on the one hand and the normative denominations on the other. He did mention the third way, and I want to go into that in a little detail. This is something that's been happening under the radar. A friend of mine who was one of the fellows of the West Star Institute of the Jesus Seminar, and I had a conversation about this last spring. It turns out in the last 15 years, there has been growing a very vital movement called Progressive Christianity. You may have heard of this. Not very many people know very much about it, but it is alive and well. There are something like 1,000 congregations that are involved in this movement. They are Lutheran, Episcopal, Disciples of Christ, Presbyterian, Methodist, all kinds of normative denominations. I'm going to give you an idea as to what they think, so that at some point you might want to, if you're interested in this particular movement and want to find some kind of, as this book says, a new spiritual home, you can do the investigation properly. I'm going to mention one example in particular. There is a church in Grand Haven, Michigan, Lutheran in background, Norwegian Lutheran, of course I would gravitate toward that, wouldn't I? It meets in a steakhouse, an old bar and a restaurant, but it serves the community, the university and college communities of Muskegon, Michigan, basically. It's just a little south of that. The group does not have a pastor as such. It has what is called a mission developer, hired by the denominational structures of the Evangelical Lutheran Church of America. This is the country's largest Lutheran denomination. In spite of the fact that I've taken myself out of my own nurture, that old tradition of mine, I have a very strong fondness for the history and the power and the density of that tradition, particularly in the music. I grew up in choirs, met my wife in a choir, sang in choirs for most of my life. What do they think of? How do they work? Well, first of all, their worship service is lay-oriented. This is a layman movement. This is something that's happening kind of within and against some of the standard denominations. The lay people are the ones that design the worship. They have a certain openness to other religions. They are inclusive in their outlook. And I'm describing one specific group here, and you can find several hundred of them in this book. They are explicitly integrative of world religions. Many of the readings, the lectionary readings that occur in the worship services come from Buddhism and Sufism and Hinduism and Native American religions and all of that. They have a common meal, which is modeled after the open table of the New Testament that we think the historical Jesus was fond of. This inclusive thing, everybody is invited, even Samaritans. Although it is explicitly Christian, it is non-creedal. They really, truly believe that there are other paths that are just as valid for other people on the way to enlightenment, to religious power, and all that kind of thing. They are pretty liberal in the way they look at things, and they're wide open to people of different sexual orientations and all the rest of that. John Shelby Spong, who was the retired bishop of the Anglican Church in Newark, New Jersey, describes so many in the standard congregations as Christians in exile. Sit in congregations, they listen to whatever word that they're hearing, and as a consequence of this, or to have reservations, they get into a dialectic with the pastor. It's usually a silent one. Like every time I go to a wedding, last one was was a Roman Catholic wedding, I was in real serious dialectic with the priest involved in that. Yes, that's true, but maybe not this, and I would modify that, and so on and so forth, all in my head. Do you know how you do this kind of thing? I bet you do that kind of thing. They are attempting also, and here's another point. Remember, it's religion, science, and art. They are using all kinds of art, poetry and music, particularly stories and the rest of it, to create new liturgies. This is what's happening to these people. And as a given, the modern scientific paradigms, all of them, in chemistry and physics and in biology and all the rest of it, are accepted without criticism. This is just simply part of the worldview that they have. As I say, there's a homepage that you might look at some point called the Center of Center of Progressive Christianity, and they have 8 points, only two or three of which I will read to you, that are characteristic of this particular movement. They recognize the faithfulness of other people that have other names for the way to God's realm, and acknowledge that their ways are true for them as our ways are true for us. They invite all people to participate in the community without insisting that they become like us as believers. They include believers and agnostics and conventional Christians and questioning skeptics and women and men, the whole works. The sixth point to me is one of the most important ones. They find more grace, and here's the science again, in the search for understanding than we do in a dogmatic certainty, more value in questioning than in absolutes. Now, this is this almost subterranean, under the radar movement that has been developing in very significant ways for the past 15 years. I'm going to refer to a book. Now, Marshall's going to be upset with me because I'm going to try to sell a book that we didn't write. This is by Hal Tausig, a book called The New Spiritual Home. I left the citation for it with the bookstore out there. If you're interested in getting it, you should, if you're interested in this kind of thing. There are listed here 1,000 different churches involved in this movement. There are a number of them in Wisconsin, quite a number of them. There are quite a number in Madison. Now, I don't know if I should read these out loud, but I'll mention a couple of them. The Covenant Presbyterian Church in Madison, for example, has traits of the progressive movement. St. Francis House, obviously, that would be that. Lake Edge Lutheran Church, etc., etc. There's a whole bunch of them in here. Eau Claire and various places throughout the state. 1,000 of these, if you're interested in finding out one that you might be interested in. Now, I want to conclude by scolding. I'm going to scold now. I haven't scolded for a long time, but I'm going to scold this way. The options are here in this movement, this progressive, non-doctrinal, non-creedal, wide-open kind of sense of the power of the genius of Jesus, for example. This is developing, it is developing in the creation of the liturgies, in the creation of looking at creeds as if they were pieces of poetry and not scientific statements as to the truth. There are bishops who say things like, the creeds you don't recite as if it were a kind of recipe for true statements, it's something that you sing. It is a piece of poetry in that particular regard. There are 1,000 churches listed in this book, and each one of them has one, I think, basic presupposition, that you do not leave your brains at the door. when you come into the church. Simple as that. Now, here's the scold. I've been wanting to say this for a long time. I cannot understand for the life of me why so much of the television and radio airwaves are dominated by one group, far right group. I cannot figure that out. I don't know what there is about it, but it, to me, it does not represent what is actually happening in the country so far as the spiritual development of the church itself is concerned. And it would seem to me that if you're at all involved in searching for the things that are described in the book, the things that I have been describing, you ought to do something to get those people off the air and get something else on the air that is a little bit more reasonable and sensible for those who are, in fact, Christians in exile. It doesn't make it, I mean, every time I turn on the television, I listen on the shortwave radio when I can't sleep. I have a shortwave radio with a little timer on it. And I wander through the shortwave bands and I find the most radical, fundamentalist evangelical I can find. R.G. Stair from Walterboro, South Carolina. The man's crazy. But he puts me to sleep just like that. That's my sleeping pill. But the things he says are just beyond human rational belief. The end of the world and all the Jews are going to be picked up, 144 million of them and any, or 1,000 of them, whatever the number is, and everybody has to be converted and perfected, otherwise they get killed, and the lake of blood will reach up to the horse's withers, wherever the withers are. I think it's in the shoulders or someplace like this. And it's almost as if he's happy that there's going to be this horrific bloodbath at the end of the world. And I think that's crazy. But it does put me to sleep, as I say. So if you ever are interested in exploring what is turning out to be a real option in the church that I grew up in, even though I, as I say, have taken myself out of the tradition to a certain extent, I am very fond of it and I want to see it survive and to see it flourish. And by the way, there's even in this book described in some detail something called the Catholic Resistance Movement, in which the progressive movement within the Catholic Church are having people meet quietly in homes for the purpose of having women give the sacraments and all that kind of stuff. So it's all there. Take a look at it, and I hope R.G. Stair ultimately gets off the air. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
It is question time. And I'm going to take the liberty of asking the first question. I've been very good as moderator and allowed the speakers to speak and the audience to join right away with questions. But Stephen, the topic tonight was Eastern religions.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
I'd like you to say something specific, something about your own experience of being an initiate in Zen Buddhism and to tell us something more about the actual experience of what it is to belong to an Eastern religion.
Yeah, so that I can do that.
I'll do it quickly. The Eastern religion that I did talk about is what is infiltrated into the society now. I can do it fairly quickly for you. I think I mentioned 3 times ago that I was a deracinated human being. That is to say that my mother died in her 25th house, and so I had no geographical roots, and so I was kind of free to think and work on my own, pretty much. 1968, my brother was killed in Vietnam. My dad died 2 months and 2 days later. So that caused me to rethink a lot of things. I was a seminary student at the Luther Theological Seminary in St. Paul. I had to leave there because, as I mentioned earlier, my dad and my grandfather and my uncle and my cousin and my great-grandfather and my great-great-grandfather were all Lutheran pastors. I was there on inertia. I didn't find that out until I got there, and as a consequence of that, I thought to myself, I don't belong here anymore, I better leave. So I did. And in the course of the upheaval of all of that, particularly in 68, I underwent some psychological things. they call it a nervous breakdown. I think I just kind of was wigging out over this and that and the other thing. In 1975, I found myself in a meditation group. I'm not quite sure how I got there, but I was there, and then I wound up ultimately exploring Buddhism. Because of my philosophical and historical training, I found it essential to have a scholastic discipline. The Buddhist scholasticism is very difficult, and it does take a certain amount of effort and time to even begin to master. I will not say that I have mastered any of it. Right now, I think I'm working on the First Noble Truth. I've been doing that for the last 15 years. I may get to the Second Noble Truth someday, but I'm on the First Noble Truth, but I'm really getting that. I'm doing very well with that. I found myself in Japan at a Zen temple. I was given a naming ceremony there, and I've taken 3 initiations at Deer Park, 2 with the Dalai Lama, 1 with a man by the name of Lhate Rinpoche, in which I took what were essentially the vows of the Bodhisattva. The Bodhisattva vows to the Buddhist mean in the literature of Buddhism is that you resist entering into nirvana fully until you have done the work to help other people. It's a very outwardly expressed ethic. Helping other people has to do with bringing people to awareness, which is simply what the Buddha said. If you were to reduce it to one word, what would the word be? And he would say awareness. And then ultimately to help people who explore the tradition to undertake the appropriate disciplines in meditation to advance along the path. I am not much of a joiner of things, although I've affiliated myself and support the work of the Deer Park. I like it out there because as an old Lutheran, it's a very liturgical place. And I like liturgy. I like singing and chanting and beating up drums and horns and stuff. That's all a lot of fun for me. And I do enjoy Geshe Sopa's discourses. Very bright guy, full professor here at the university who worked in Buddhist studies for about 25 or more years, I think. The discipline of meditation helped me out. I began with meditation and then ultimately branched out into these other things. The discipline of meditation has helped me in terms of achieving a certain psychological equanimity, although there is one area that I'm having difficulty with, and that's appetite. Look at me. I failed there. But I have a new mantra that I told my doctor today, TGMG. The gut must go. That's my new mantra. He says it's pretty good. Okay? That's, in brief terms, the pilgrimage that I underwent.
And if I can indulge one more, just because it's not quite 8 o'clock. Marshall, why do you love science? What does science do for you?
One of my both vivid memories as a kid, in second grade, I was about 7, was trying to hear what my parents and my teacher were talking about through a keyhole during a parent-teacher conference. Now, this was just after Sputnik, and I don't know how it was in the rest of the country, but everybody in Louisiana gave first and second graders the science test. And shortly after that, there was a parent-teacher conference with my parents. Now, any sensible second grader looks at parent-teachers' conferences, especially unscheduled ones, with deep suspicion. This no good can come of things like this when you're 7 or 8 years old. And all of a sudden, my parents thought different. They thought, you have a brain. We never knew this before.
Well hidden.
Under layers and layers of Southern
Stubbornness.
Expressiveness. So there's a lot of, all seriousness aside, there was a lot of positive reinforcement for anyone who could walk, chew gum, and do arithmetic in 1957. And so there was a lot of kudos to be gained. But the other thing was that I think my parents would probably have been arrested for child neglect today with the way they raised me, at least. I mean, where I lived in Lafayette, which is in the south central part of Louisiana, otherwise known as a swamp, our house, along with the houses on the street, were the end of the subdivision, and in back of our house was a swamp, because that's the natural state of south central Louisiana. And of course, you can imagine the attractiveness of a swamp to the local kids. Nowadays, of course, you don't let kids go into a swamp, but in the 1950s you did. And most of them actually came back. And so I was given a lot of elbow room to just do what I wanted to do and follow my interest. And my interest happened to be in the area of mathematics. And I can still remember again when I was 11 or 12, deciding I needed to know some chemistry. Now, what I really wanted to do was to know how to make explosives. But I didn't tell that to my parents. Instead, I just said, I need to get a chemistry book. So we went and got a used bookstore and got a college chemistry book for a 12-year-old. And my father said, yeah, here, kid, here's your chemistry book. Study it. You know, college chemistry when you're 12 years old is not easy. And I never did learn how to make trinitrotoluene. But in the process, I learned a lot of chemistry. I just didn't learn the good stuff. So I think that the whole country in that period right after Sputnik was really keen to encourage people who were interested in science. And remember, Crick and Watson had only broken the DNA code a couple of years before that. And so it was, and then when I was 11, John Kennedy said we were going to be on the moon. And by God, we were. So it was a period in which a person interested, who had any interest in science, had every encouragement given to that person to do what they could do. And if you combine encouragement and elbow room with most kids, then things tend to work out pretty well. And I think, again, the elbow room is important, because I look at my neighbors and the way they raise their kids, and I think of them as bubble wrapped. And it doesn't do the kids any good to be bubble wrapped. Although I have to admit that the water moccasins were not the best part of the swamp.
Okay, now your question. And you guys said you wanted to stand at the microphone to to take the question, so I'll let you go ahead and call on the folks.
Okay. I am wondering, I am touched by the progressive Christian movement that is 15 years old. I'm wondering why there has been no mention at all of the Unitarian Universalist movement, which is about 200 years old, and has really espoused a great many of exactly the things that you have pointed out.
When Taussig discusses this in the book, he lists a number of Unitarian Universalist churches that are in fact involved. His criteria for describing these was as a lay movement, strongly lay movement with the creation of new liturgies using art and all the rest of it. And so he didn't mention the Unitarian Universalists specifically as it being involved, although I know that they are. But in the list, you'll find quite a large number of them. And I think the one, I think the list has the Madison one involved in it as well.
Thank you.
There first.
I appreciate very much the way you divided out the religious scene, because I think you have identified the basic divide in the whole religious scene of the world. Sounds oversimplified, but I don't think it is. And that's between the two camps you identified. The what is the term? Normative on the one side and the monist on the other. I use the term objectivist and subjectivist. Others look at the way they go about thinking, and the normative would use deduction from given truths, and the monist side would use induction from a process of discovery and unfolding without assumed truths. And I think that's really where everything divides, and I think it divides at a even in the individual. I happen to be a Methodist minister. I'm a member of the progressive organization. I go to one of the progressive Methodist churches here in town. You did not name, and there are many, particularly in the United Church of Christ, and some of the Baptist churches, and even some of the Lutheran churches, and even maybe, well, no, I wouldn't say Catholic churches. But as you pointed out, there's a strong progressive movement in the Catholic Church. But the point I want to make is that back in college, I was struggling with the pull from these two sides without knowing the terms to describe it. Somehow I had in my mind, even though I didn't know I was raised in such a progressive home, but I was, I had in mind that as an active Christian Methodist youth, I would be on the objectivist side, and it didn't make sense, so I was struggling with that. And then I had a born-again conversion experience. And I was born again to the progressive point of view 50 years ago. And what the epiphany was, that if you want to be an objectivist, dogmatist, deductive person, you cannot do that unless you first make a subjective decision to give your authority over to whatever authority you adopt as the central thing. So it dawned on me that the central starting place, even though it may just because we're captured in our own finitude, that the starting place for everybody is a subjective searching. And some people, my explanation for the dominance of the objective side is that it takes a lot of courage to be a progressive, especially in a time like this when none of the big verities hold sway anymore. We're in one of the cracks of history. I also think I have an explanation for why so much of the airwaves is given over to the objectivists, is because they can raise the money to be on the air, right. And I think it's the authoritarian political sources that are willing to give them that money because this gives them an attitude, a avenue for control. What do you think of that?
I don't have very much to add. I tend to agree.
Yes, sir.
Let me do that just briefly. Just one quick comment. It does take a certain amount of gumption to pull away from that. My own background was very objectivist. But, you know, in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, before the progressive movements had occurred, before the infiltration of the monist faiths had come into the country, everybody was objectivist. But it still was painful to pull away from that. Now, I was lucky. I began to think for myself as a young boy as well, as Marshall did apparently. And as it happened, my authority figure, my father, was off fighting our nation's wars between 1939 and 1945, a crucial period, raised by my mother, a mystical Swede. And Dad came home and tried to reacquire authority over his sons. Too late. too late. But I did go to the seminary because of the inertia, and leaving that was very hard to do, yes.
Question over here. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's another level of abstractions or activity or whatever going on, and I'm curious about your thoughts about the dogma in science, that scientists become so wedded to their models, and you see that over and over, you know, Kuhn talks about the structure of scientific revolutions, that the generation has to die before the new models arise.
There's no doubt at all that if you took a lot of individual scientists, they're as dogmatic as a Bible thumper, no question. To the extent that science is able to avoid dogmatism, and it's not always possible that they can do, it's not a matter of individuals, because with people you get what you select for. You don't get a character test going into science. You, nobody gives you a Minnesota psychological blot test on, are you going to be an ethical human being before you become a physicist and develop nuclear weapons? No, I don't think so. So consequently, you get the normal range of people because you haven't selected for any particular ethical quality. So to the extent that science as an activity is able to avoid dogma, and as I say, it's not always been possible, it's based on a couple of things. One is the way the activity is organized, and the other is competition and credit, which have almost no analogy in the arts or in religious thinking. If I make a painting, it may be a lousy painting, and trust me, it will be a lousy painting if it comes from me, but I don't have to worry about somebody else stealing my painting idea. First off, nobody would be that stupid. But second off, there's an individual creativity there that is because it's individual. In science, you've got a universe to figure out, but it's the same universe, otherwise we're all wasting our time. And so credit is very important to a scientist. So consequently, there's an enormous competition within science to get it right and get it first. The two don't necessarily have to go hand in hand. There's an old joke in physics, at least, publish in haste, print the erratum at your leisure. Who knows, you might be right. Okay, that's a little over the top. And if you do that too often, that people stop listening to you and they make bad remarks when you pass in the hallways. But there's still this idea that you have to be first and you have to be right. And if you're wrong, believe me, your colleagues will be the first to tell you so. They'll have no problem at all. But even with that, even with those safeguards, in our country, we've done some really, really dumb things in the area of science. I mean, look at the eugenics movements in our country, just to pick the most, to me, the most egregious example. That's the sort of thing where they should have been laughed off of the lectern 5 minutes after they started talking, and instead they were actually treated as respectable scientists for decades. So it can go wrong, but that, to the extent that it doesn't go wrong, it's not because the individuals are nicer or less dogmatic, it's because of the competition that keeps people honest.
Let me just throw out a quick comment also about why these conservative churches thrive in the media. And it seems to me, you may be correct in what you say, but let me take a different tack, and my position would be that they are going for the money from the get-go. They can start a little show and a little program on the radio or something. They're playing with guilt, they're playing with fear, they're playing going to hell. You know, they push all the buttons, and they're after the money from the beginning. That generates more money, more airtime, more money, more airtime, and it grows like that. Whereas progressive churches, it seems to me, are embarrassed by the money, and even more so embarrassed by asking for the money.
This has been going on for at least 500 years. Martin Luther began his Reformation by dealing with the indulgence sales of Tetzel in the 16th century. When a coin into the coffer rings a soul from purgatory springs. I mean, that was the kind of thing that's going on. Very common thing has been happening for a long period of time. I think you're right about the progressive movement. I think they're a little embarrassed by even becoming very well known in some respects. But I think you make a good deal of sense there.
Any other question?
I can't hear you at all.
I can't hear you.
Do you think as a species we will evolve to be more perceptive about spiritual matters and then be able to answer some of these questions, or are we?
What was the first part of the statement?
Will we as a species evolve and become more spiritual and be able to better understand spiritual matters?
Steve will undoubtedly have his own opinion. As for mine, I haven't the foggiest idea.
Well, since we wrote the book together and have had common ground, I kind of agree with that. I don't know, simply. It would be nice, you know, that the evolutionary process isn't done yet, and that these kinds of things would become easier in the future, but with Marshall, I just simply do not know. That is, if we survive another 100 years. You know, some of the worst scenarios with climate change are suggesting that it's finished in 100 years. That means that even my own grandchildren will be gone, so I feel, you know, not too bad about that.
If I could just add one comment on that, the Jesuit paleontologist Pierre-Marie de Teilhard de Chardin actually was, this was the essence of his insight into the evolution of all matter to the point of spirit, and that his understanding of anthropology, of the human person, was that humanity had become matter self-conscious and would continue to evolve until all of the universe was conscious in the oneness, which of course the Buddhists had discovered, you know, centuries and centuries ago, as really the purpose of the spiritual journey is to discover that oneness. But Teilhard de Chardin's understanding was that this is indeed part of the whole process of creation and evolution. So it's not just a, you know, it's not the first time that anybody's asked the question.
Wasn't the golden noosphere?
Yeah.
Going toward a certain kind of universal mind. The word nous in Greek means mind.
Other questions? Yes, sir.
I think you are in some ways idealizing science, and you are in some ways idealizing Eastern religion. One of the things, I'm a university professor, and I have lots of colleagues who are scientists.
Yeah.
And they tell me that they basically see themselves as a worldwide community of people dedicated to research, to discovery, for various purposes, but the overall purpose is the betterment of mankind. Now, to me, that talks about a commitment. It talks about a kind of faith. The rest of us who aren't scientists have watched this go on. Scientists, of course, will say, well, don't talk to us about applied theory. Don't talk to us about technique or engineering. They are not part of science. But engineers have taken all the theories of science, may have finished, please, and run with it in all kinds of directions. Civilians, non-scientists, have looked at all of this. Today, we see a huge body of scientists saying, there is no global warming. Let's keep doing what we're doing. You see another huge group saying, there is global warming. Let's stop it. So the civilians are sort of confused. How can this great community be so divided? How can there not be an objective way to lay this all out? Now my second question has to do with religion. The very monisms you're talking about in the East, if you were in Japan in a Zen monastery, when you used the urinal, there was a deity at that urinal. The Tibetan Buddhists you practice with believe in karma very thoroughly. That is a very powerful kind of faith. and they do rituals that involve hundreds and hundreds of deities. You really aren't addressing those issues. And the last point I want to make is, if you go to a much deeper level, what makes a fundamentalist a fundamentalist? What makes a progressive Christian a progressive Christian? It is a human struggle. And we are all the same in the basis of that human struggle. The fundamentalist, the monist, the normative person, the scientist. And I think we have to always respect the integrity of that struggle.
Okay. Do you want to go first?
One of the doctrines of my old upbringing coming out of the Lutheran tradition is a good, healthy sense of sin. And so when I look at the religious people that I've become familiar with, there certainly are a bunch of rascals in that, and I agree with that 100%. You do have to go deeper. So far as the universality of the scientific enterprise is concerned, Marcia can talk more about that later. But there was, in the Middle Ages, a thing called the Republic of Letters, whose language was Latin, and it was a European-wide kind of community of scholars. We know very well from reading the biography of some of those scholars and the conflicts and the violence that occurred sometimes between them, that the same kind of rascals that a good Lutheran sense of sin describes was there as well. I have absolutely no illusions whatsoever about the automatic virtue of any one of the groups, and I would look for different kinds of ideologies. For example, Karen Armstrong talks about the growth of worldwide fundamentalism as a response. It's a fairly new movement, and it's a response to modernity. And that being the case, you can begin to look at the causation there. The notion of karma in Buddhism, you can secularize. To me, it's nothing more than a cause and consequent matrix. You do something, something happens. There are consequences to the things you do. There's a group of radical Burmese monks writing now in, and this is a citation they give to you in the second volume of Heinrich Dumoulin's History of Zen Buddhism, who take the idea of reincarnation and say, no, that's not life after life after life, that's the progress of the spirit within each individual psyche. So there's all kinds of different ways of approaching that, and I take them all seriously, as you suggest. I think you have to qualify it with a good, healthy sense of the potential for wickedness any group has. I call myself a Lubu, Lutheran Buddhist, for that reason, I think.
You raised two questions regarding science. One was an assertion. You said that the scientists with whom you speak are disdainful of anything except pure science. We obviously travel in different social circles. In among the physicists, I know part of what you've described is entirely accurate. Physicists view themselves as members of an international community of physicists, of scientists. That part, I think, is certainly the case. But as for the idea of pure physics or pure science versus mere engineering, well, the only person to win the Nobel Prize in physics twice was an engineer. He's from here, John Bardeen. Bachelor's, master's, electrical engineering, University of Wisconsin, Madison. First Nobel Prize shared with two other people for co-inventing the transistor. I can hardly imagine a more practical application. Second Nobel Prize shared by two people, his postdoc and his student, for providing a microscopic explanation for superconductivity. Again, that's more theoretical. It was theoretical physics, but it was certainly an area that had wide applications and continues to have. The standard joke in the physics community regarding that was his student, Robert Schrieffer from Illinois. He was about to finish his PhD in physics at the University of Illinois when his thesis advisor, John Bardeen, said, would you be interested in working on a project with my postdoc and me? It'll add a year to your thesis time. And Bardeen thought about it for 3 weeks before saying yes. And that's why the theory is now called the Bardeen-Cooper-Schrieffer theory of superconductivity. Good choice. Well, the second point you made was, how can it be on, say, global warming, that you can have seemingly reputable scientists giving diametrically opposed statements about, is there global warming? And if so, how big is the problem? And if so, what can we do about it? Well, I'll start with where Stephen left off. Remember, when you are talking about scientists, you are talking about a group of people who have not been selected for ethical behavior. That means that you get the entire range of ethical behavior that you get in humanity. One of those co-Nobel laureates with John Bardeen, the first one on the transistor, was a man named Robert Shockley, who spent the last 20 years of his life explaining how white people are better than everybody else. You can imagine how well that went over in the international physics community. Yeah. So, you get the whole range. Now you throw in big money from corporations, and you throw in big money from environmental interest groups. Stir briskly, and you have a situation, as we talk about in our book, where I cannot believe anything I read from scientists until I've come up with a test check myself. Because it's simply too important a question to ignore, and it's too much money and too much influence involved to believe any individual person on any part of any side of this question. The last part is a little more, it's a little different from the fallibility of human beings. And that is, the problem is bloody hard. Okay? Let me give you an idea of where we are in computational physics, which is what you're talking about, modeling the climate of the planet. I have a friend who shall remain nameless to protect the guilty, but he is a distinguished theoretical physicist at a Midwestern university. About 15 years ago, people around the world began to figure out how to make atomically flat, atomically thin layers of magnetic materials. Now, all of us know that a single atom of iron is not a bar magnet. You need a big chunk of the stuff for it to become ferromagnetic. But there was a report in Physical Review Letters that people had made a single atomic layer of gadolinium, and it was a better ferromagnet than bulk gadolinium, which was completely counterintuitive. In the next issue of Physical Review Letters, there were two new articles on this subject. One from my friend, who had a theoretical explanation based on his model that explained why it was that way. The other from the experimental group reporting an erratum saying, oops, we made a mistake. It's actually a worse ferromagnet than the bulk material. And now I'm supposed to, as a physicist, believe that if you can't get a single atomic layer of gadolinium right with your calculations, you can get the planet? I don't think so. So I think the real problem is it's a bloody hard problem.
one brief anecdote. One of the brightest guys I knew in my high school, I finally found, and it turned out that I admired him because he was just a very brilliant guy, great tenor voice, and we sang in a choir together. He was really hitting me pretty hard, this whole issue of global warming, and he sent me a document that purported to say that everything that anybody's ever said about it is all wrong, so therefore, Steve, you were all wrong. Thank you, Tim. Well, I like Marshall, I like to test things myself, so I did a search on this guy. Turns out he is a physicist who works with the petroleum companies.
To me, religious faith has a lot to do with maybe the spirit, the soul, and I'm wondering, you had a reference to a kind of a universal soul to progress concept earlier in the question, and the individual itself, life after death, reincarnation, or simply is there a development of the soul? How do we relate interactively? This is something I think is pretty far-fetched from where science is now. Can you comment on this?
Yeah. I will answer for both Marshall and myself. I simply don't know about that. The whole notion of the word soul goes back, you know, to psyche in Greek and pneuma and all those words that mean breath and prana and all the rest of it. Most traditions have a notion of the soul. The Jewish tradition doesn't quite believe in the immortality of the soul the way the Greeks did, the Neoplatonists and all those. See, at 70, I'm going to be there pretty soon, although most of my people live until their middle 80s. If I could tell you what I go, what the story is, I would, but I don't think I'm going to be able to do that. Mark Twain had a wonderful statement about that. He said, you know, to be dead is to be not alive. Okay. Do you know that you have been dead for millions of years before you were born? Okay. What makes you think it's going to be any different when you die again? Well, I don't know, but that's a very interesting. I don't remember anything earlier than that, my own birth. I can remember back to the age of two, but I do not remember anything about an immortal soul. So it's just, you know, just one of these things that you keep up in the air. You don't become dogmatic about it. You understand if you use the word soul as the value that each individual has, which is the way an ex-Mormon friend of mine goes, then I can use the word soul. That's the value that each individual human being has. But I would qualify that poetically. Metaphysically, physically, I have no idea.
Just one small addendum. 20 years ago, if a neurologist or a psychologist wrote a research proposal saying, I'm going to study out-of-body experiences, two things would have happened. Number one, he would not get the money. And number two, his career would be over, flat, done. But there are now research proposals and programs in place to actually try to find out what can be found out on these questions. I don't mean to dismiss the efforts, because the efforts are worthwhile. It's just going to be another bloody hard problem. Physicists, say what you want about weapons of mass destruction and destroying the planet and all the good things that have come from physics, but we're at least sensible people. We know when to run and hide. And when you have a problem like this, you don't see physicists looking into these problems. We know they're too hard for us. No, seriously. It's going to be a really hard problem. But I'm glad to see that there are some brave and perhaps not completely sensible people who are willing to spend their life expectancy trying to find out what can be found out. I would not expect the rate of insight to be fast.
I'm sorry, but our time has past. We're supposed to be out here, and the library does need to close by 9 o'clock. I just wanted to share with you a discovery. My partner and I subscribe to Tikkun magazine. Some of you may have know of this magazine. It's a Jewish magazine and an interfaith movement. It's the start of, it was the place where the Network of Spiritual Progressives was launched. And just to let you know, what is the Network of Spiritual Progressives? It has set out to transform all our institutions, policies, and social practices so that they encourage rather than undermine our ability to treat every human being as an embodiment of the sacred, or to use secular terms, as having inherent worth and dignity, and our ability to respond to the universe with awe, wonder, and radical amazement. And in the November-December issue, the whole issue is dedicated to science and spirit, which I thought was very appropriate to our series. And the opening page of the article on science and spirit says, "One reality, two kinds of knowledge. How can they work together to save the world?" So I think it would be very appropriate for folks to pick up Tikkun. The next article says, "Let's act together on global warming." And with an illustration of human beings with different kinds of light bulbs, it says, "You're going to fix global warming by changing your light bulbs? Try changing your politicians instead. Screw in a new congressperson." So have a wonderful week, and hope to see you in Stoughton next week.